I realize this may be a controversial way to start out an episode, but from what I've gathered, this is the only way I see it. Supernatural beings such as angels and demons don't exist. Well, what I'm saying is that there is no data that support they exist. Sure, many have made cases, but it usually makes its way back to the cultural cul-de-sac of "the Bible tells me so." Some of you may be currently rolling your eyes pretty hard right now, but stick this one out. It may surprise you. Or not. I don't know. Maybe it won't. But my hope is to get you to think deeper about angels and demons, other than just the notion that they exist. You're a smart person, which is why we need to hold controversial topics like this in the public discourse. And if you came here just for the demon lore, you're in luck. That will be in part two, and it'll come next week. Let's take a moment to slow down and really examine the idea of supernatural beings like angels and demons. Across cultures and religions, these beings show up in stories, art, and personal experiences. But here's a question worth asking. What does the evidence say? When we look closely through the lens of history, anthropology, literature, and psychology, we will find that there's no empirical evidence confirming the literal existence of supernatural beings like angels and demons. That doesn't mean people don't believe in them. It means that the kinds of evidence we use to confirm other realities, like consistent physical observations, reproducible experiments, or verifiable records, simply don't show up here. What we do find, and quite consistently, is a fascinating pattern of how these ideas evolved. Stories of angels and demons reflect the fears, values, and power structures of the societies that created them. They're not random. They're deeply human, shaped by cultural storytelling, political shifts, and religious traditions. In a way, it's theology mixed with centuries of myth-making. A witch's brew, if I may. So when someone studies these patterns and concludes that angels and demons might not be real in a literal sense, that's not necessarily about bias. It's about reasoning from the available evidence. It's the same kind of thinking we apply to other questions in history and science. Of course, I wouldn't want to discount that personal experience matters. Many people feel they've encountered something beyond the ordinary, and those stories are very meaningful to them. But here's the challenge. When we scrutinize these accounts, they often vary dramatically across cultures. In one region, it's a radiant figure with wings. In another, it's a dark entity speaking in an unknown tongue. These experiences, as powerful as they are, tend to reflect local traditions and media more than a consistent external reality. And where the stories do align, well, it's often found that they're drawing from the same sources: received traditions, authoritative religious texts, community narratives, or films that were, you know, inspired by true events. They become echoes of the same ideas rather than independent confirmations of something objectively real. This doesn't mean dismissing people's experiences outright. It means looking at them with curiosity and a critical eye. It may be beneficial to ask questions such as, why do these stories persist? What human needs do they speak to? How does belief in them shape our choices and societies? And does the thought of these stories elicit a fear response? Ultimately, we're not here to mock belief, but to examine it. The goal isn't to tear anything down, it's to build understanding. If a belief is true, it should stand up to scrutiny. And if it's not, isn't it more powerful to know the truth? Or at least a truth that has very robust explanations that are supported by experimental data, observational data, mathematical equations, and computer simulations? So let's pause and ask a deeper question here. When someone challenges the idea of supernatural beings like demons, is it really an attack on our faith and ultimately our character? Or is it an invitation to think more carefully about how we form our beliefs? Sometimes it can feel like science and belief are locked in a standoff. But are they really playing the same game? Science, by its nature, is always open to being proven wrong if the evidence is there. Can we say the same about our own beliefs? And here's something worth considering. Did most of us come to believe in things like demons after examining the evidence? Or did we start with the belief and then try to work backwards from there? That's not criticism. It's a very human thing to do. We all do it, especially when something feels deeply personal or tied to our sense of identity. But when we're asked for concrete evidence, observable, measurable, testable examples, what do we actually bring to the table? Is it firsthand data, or is it stories and scriptures? If it's stories, how do we know they point to something real and not just something that is personally meaningful to us? When we can't fully explain something, we may say something like, well, science can't explain everything, so maybe demons? But let's unpack that. Does a gap in knowledge automatically mean that anything can fill the void? If we don't know exactly what's at the center of a black hole, does that mean it could be fairies or elves? Or is that just our brain in the discomfort of not knowing, trying to resolve itself? There's a tendency to try to level the playing field. Well, science has unknowns and so does religion, so maybe they're just two equal ways of seeing the world. But is that actually true? Is it enough for a belief system to simply have an answer? Or should it matter how the answer was arrived at? And maybe the hardest question of all, are we open to changing our minds? Or are we clinging to something simply because it's familiar, comforting, or part of a tradition we've always known? Do we cling to it because we're afraid to leave? These aren't easy questions, but they are important ones. And wrestling with them doesn't mean giving up your beliefs. It means respecting them enough to test their foundations. What if I were to make a claim that the concept of supernatural beings, such as demons, were a tool used within mass movements? Movements like organized religion as a means to shepherd the flock, so to say. Or perhaps to others, it may just look like controlling the masses. Eric Hoffer, an American moral and social philosopher best known for his plain-spoken insights into mass movements and human behavior, saw something most of us overlook. The deep, restless hunger that drives people to surrender themselves to causes greater than themselves. His 1951 book, The True Believer, explores the psychology of fanaticism, analyzing how and why individuals join mass movements, whether religious, political, or revolutionary. Hoffer argues that such movements attract frustrated people seeking purpose and identity. He reveals how disillusionment and longing can transform ordinary individuals into fervent followers. It's not ideology that fuels fanaticism, he suggests, but the need to belong, to matter, to escape the self. In his book, he writes that
hatred, as well as fear, is the most accessible and comprehensive of all the unifying agents. Mass movements can rise and spread without belief in a god, but never without a belief in a devil.
He goes on to say that
the enemy, the indispensable devil of every mass movement, is omnipresent. He plots both outside and inside the ranks of the faithful. It is his voice that speaks through the mouth of the dissenter, and the deviationists are his stooges. If anything goes wrong within the movement, it is his doing. It is the sacred duty of the true believer to be suspicious. He must be constantly on the lookout for saboteurs, spies, and traitors.
Isn't that devil often just someone else? For many Christians, blame becomes a ritual, scapegoating the outsider, the sinner, the other, as a way to feel righteous. But maybe what we condemn in others isn't about them at all. Hoffer reminds us,
self-contempt, however vague, sharpens our eyes for the imperfections of others. We usually strive to reveal, in others, the blemishes we hide in ourselves.
This sounds pretty similar to a certain Matthew 7:5 passage about removing the plank from our own eye, does it not? Speaking of condemning and demonizing others, you may have heard some folks lately claim that people who use singular they-them pronouns are somehow connected to demons in the Bible, because supposedly demons refer to themselves in the plural. Let's clear this up. First, in the New Testament, when demons say we or us, that's just standard first-person plural, the same way any group talks about itself. There is zero instance in scripture where demons use singular they-them pronouns. And there's zero biblical connection between modern pronoun use and anything demonic. This is linguistic fantasy, not theology. So, why did they make this connection? Well, here's the second and more troubling layer. It's an attempt to flip the power script. The people pushing this idea often come from the most privileged social groups. And they're targeting some of the most marginalized, non-binary and gender diverse people, and casting them as spiritual villains. It's an old tactic. Looking at the Book of Revelation, the oppressive empire is identified as the villain, and the small, marginalized band of Jesus followers are the persecuted. But if you are the empire today, and you still want to play the role of the persecuted church, you need a villain to fit the script. So, you recast the oppressed as the oppressor. And if you can label them as demonic, you supercharge that false narrative. This isn't biblical discernment, it's spiritualized scapegoating. It harms real people, twists scripture, and props up existing power structures. Frankly, it's time for this rhetoric to end. Trans people make up just 1% of the population, and they are being scapegoated for everything from moral decline to economic instability. President Trump even claimed America is no longer wealthy because of spending on transgender this, transgender that, a statement that turns real economic issues into a cultural war weapon. It would be absurd if it weren't so dangerous. In the US, trans people face violence at more than twice the rate of their cisgender peers. Murders of trans individuals have surged in recent years, especially among Black trans women. Instead of addressing this crisis with compassion, lawmakers have responded with hostility. In 2024 alone, over 690 bills were introduced across 43 states targeting trans rights. What we're witnessing isn't a debate, it's a campaign of dehumanization. And the people making these claims? They need to grow the hell up and stop confusing their cultural and political discomfort with God's judgment. You've probably heard the phrase, America is a Christian nation. But what if that's not just wrong? What if it's dangerous? What if it's actually, hear me out, demonic? There was this lawyer and theologian named William Stringfellow. He lived in Harlem during the 1960s, worked in civil rights, living among the poor, and watching America up close, both its power and its violence. And he came to a startling conclusion. Not only is America not a Christian nation, he said it's a demonic principality. Sounds dramatic, right? But hear him out. Stringfellow pulled from Ephesians 6:12, that verse that says,
"We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, spiritual wickedness in high places."
He didn't see that as a metaphor. He believed those powers were real. Not with horns and red tails, but dressed in suits, wrapped in flags, speaking the language of God while wielding the tools of death. And if that sounds abstract, let's make it plain. January 6 wasn't just a riot. It was a moment when the cross and the flag were carried side by side in an attempted coup. Despite what you think about the actual act of entering the Capitol, the post-performative effect was the same. Some pastors called it a revival. One compared it to Jericho. And many Christians defended it as the hand of God moving through patriots. This is exactly what Stringfellow warned about. A church so seduced by empire that it can't tell the difference between worshiping God and worshiping power. He said the powers and principalities aren't just government or corporations. They can be churches too. Any institution that demands loyalty, resists truth, and survives by dealing in death. Not just literal death, but the death of imagination, of compassion, of hope, of empathy. That's what he called demonic. There are many who deal in this death that Stringfellow talks about. Many consider faith leaders such as John MacArthur, Mark Driscoll, Paula White, Ali Beth Stuckey, Josh Howerton, and Doug Wilson, among many others, in this way. And here's the terrifying part. These powers don't usually look evil. In fact, they pretend to be righteous. They speak of freedom, faith, and family, while they crush dissent and protect privilege. They replace the cross with a flag and call it the same thing. Stringfellow believed that's why so many churches today can't tell the truth. Why they bless billionaires but mock the poor, defend war but dismiss mercy, and care more about personal salvation than systemic injustice. Because personal salvation doesn't ask you to question power, it asks you to conform. He warned that when the church baptizes empire, it's not just compromising, it's worshiping death. And how do the powers win? Not by forcing us to serve them, but by making us believe they're inevitable. William Stringfellow reads Revelation not as a prophecy of the end, but as a mirror of the present. The demonic, he says, isn't about creatures or monsters. It's anything that denies our humanity. And the powers and principalities aren't supernatural beings, but the real systems and institutions, political, economic, social, that demand our obedience. For Stringfellow, the struggle of revelation is happening now, resisting those powers and reclaiming what it means to be fully human.
All demonic claims against human life have a common denominator. Each and every stratagem of the principality seeks the death of the specific faculties of rational and moral comprehension which specially distinguish human beings from all other creatures. Whatever form or appearance it may take, demonic aggression always aims at the immobilization or surrender, or destruction of the mind and at the neutralization or abandonment, or demoralization of the conscience. In the fall, The purpose and effort of every principality is the dehumanization of human life, categorically.
He laid out 8 stratagems of the demonic powers used to maintain control. They are 1. Denial of truth, 2. Doublespeak and overtalk, 3. Secrecy and boast of expertise, 4. Surveillance and harassment, 5. Exaggeration and deception, 6. Cursing and conjuring, 7. Usurpation and absorption, and number 8, diversion and demoralization. I'll start with the first one. Denial of truth.
A rudimentary claim with which the principalities confront and subvert persons is that truth in the sense of eventful and factual matter does not exist. The truth is usurped and displaced by a self-serving version of events or facts, with whatever means necessary to maintain the image or enhance the survival or multiply the coercive capacities of the principality. What is most significant is not the doctoring of the truth per se, but the premise that truth is non-existent, that truth is a fiction, that there can be no thorough or fair or comprehensive or detached discovery and chronicle of events, and that any handling of facts is ideologically or institutionally or otherwise tainted. Official aggressions against the media have been based upon this proposition. They take the position that the public media, by definition, have been engaged in indoctrination of a viewpoint and version which, insofar as it departs from the authorized administration line, must be either supplanted by official propaganda or suppressed. This presumption of the principalities that truth does not exist or cannot with some human diligence be uncovered and conscientiously communicated, outreaches the subversion of the discipline of journalism. It renders education, both teaching and learning, partisan and farcical, and in the end, condemns and banishes all uses of human intelligence.
The powers lie, boldly, repeatedly, not just to others, but to themselves. They deny climate science. They rewrite history. They erase suffering. The goal is to maintain the illusion of moral authority. The second is doublespeak and overtalk.
The preemption of truth is much facilitated by other language contortions or abuses which the principalities and authorities foster. The powers enthrall, delude, and enslave human beings by stopping comprehension with doublespeak, as Orwell named it. Orwell's prototype of the phenomenon of doublespeak declares, "War is peace." Sometimes doublespeak is overtalk, in which the media themselves so accentuate volume, speed, and redundancy that communication is incapacitated. The auditor's mind is so insulted, inundated, or transfixed by verbal and visual technology that it is crippled or immobilized. Thus, Americans had been for so long saturated on newscasts by Vietnam, 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 war, 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 day after day after day, that these words, relayed this way, became signals to the head to turn off.
Language becomes a weapon. Torture becomes enhanced interrogation. Civilian deaths become collateral damage. Law and order gets thrown around without ever asking whose law, whose order. George Orwell warned us in 1984 that language can be twisted until war means peace, freedom means slavery, and ignorance means strength. Through doublespeak, truth is obscured and contradiction becomes normal. It trains the mind to accept lies as truth and call it loyalty. Doublespeak can be defined as using language in a way that deliberately obscures, distorts, disguises, and even reverses the meaning of words. This was to promote doublethink, which can be defined as the ability to hold contradictory statements in one's own mind without noticing the discrepancy. Knowing them to be contradictory and believing in both of them, to use logic against logic, to repudiate morality while laying claim to it. The third is secrecy and boast of expertise.
Secrecy in politics is dehumanizing per se. Political secrecy begets a ruthless paternalism between regime and citizens, which disallows human participation in government and renders human beings hapless against manipulation by trick or propaganda or other babble. Americans are told that secrecy is an indispensable principle of government. That claim is embellished by pleas of expertise, that is, the assertion by a principality that certain affairs are too sensitive or too complicated for human beings to know about or act on. This becomes a boast that bureaucratic routine or computer programming or institutional machinations are superhuman, relegating the person to a role of spectator or acolyte, submissive and subservient to the requirements of the principality. One common and homely example is known to anyone who has ever tried to register a complaint or otherwise secure his rights in relation to principalities, like the telephone company or the power company, only to find himself in correspondence with a machine, the convenience of which takes priority.
The powers hide behind closed doors and credentials. Decisions are made in shadow, justified with jargon only insiders understand. You wouldn't get it. You're not an expert. Transparency becomes a threat. Mystery becomes control. The fourth is surveillance and harassment.
So-called security precautions become a normalized part of everyday life and business, so as to enlarge greatly the tolerance of citizens toward political surveillance and the loss of privacy. The kind of open society contemplated by the First Amendment seems impossible, and what is more ominous, seems undesirable to very many Americans. So there is little outrage when Senate hearings expose illegal military oversight of civilians, or when unprecedented political espionage is exposed, or when education is conducted in so many schools in the presence of the police or other security forces.
Dissent gets tracked, shamed, punished. Protesters get monitored. Whistleblowers get silenced. Preachers who speak out, labeled unpatriotic. The message is clear. Stay in line or suffer. The fifth is exaggeration and deception.
What may be more significant? Such commercial deception has been so common, so widespread, and practiced for such a long time that when the same techniques are politically appropriated, human resistance has already been made pliable.
Fear is a tool. Threats are magnified. Enemies are inflated. Crises are dramatized. All to justify extreme measures. The powers must always seem under siege, so that anything done in their defense feels necessary, even heroic. The sixth is cursing and conjuring.
The demonic powers curse human beings who resist them. I mean the term curse quite literally, as a condemnation to death, as a damnation.
Language here is almost liturgical. Not meant to clarify, but to invoke fear or awe. Certain words are cursed. Terrorist, radical, traitor. Others are conjured to bless. Freedom, patriot, family. It's not reason, but ritual. Casting spells over the public conscience. The seventh stratagem is usurpation and absorption.
Thus the stratagem of the principalities destroys the witness of human resistance by preemption, by fabricating opposition, by a kind of absorption. And in this manner, the authority of the state to prosecute is transmuted into the power of the state to persecute.
The powers mimic and swallow their opposition. They co-opt movements, rebrand resistance, turn prophets into mascots. Even religion gets absorbed. Repurposed as fuel for the empire. What once stood against the powers becomes another arm of them. The eighth and final stratagem is diversion and demoralization.
The demoralization of human beings in this fashion greatly conveniences the totalitarianism of the demonic powers, since the need to resort to persecutions or imprisonments is obviated, as the people are already morally captive. More than that, in circumstances where there is little citizen involvement in the realpolitik of a nation, the persecution and punishment of non-conforming persons becomes itself a form of public spectacle. For the governing authorities, and for citizens who acquiesce to a spectator role, American political prosecutions serve the same purpose as the arena events involving lions and Christians in ancient Rome. This same distracting factor is prominent, obviously, wherever scapegoats are sacrificed for the survival of principalities, whether the scapegoat be an opposing party or a class of persons.
Keep people entertained, exhausted, or at each other's throats. Flood the space with noise, spectacle, scandal. Anything to keep them from imagining alternatives, from hoping, organizing, or believing they might actually change something. And remember, Stringfellow wrote this all in the 1970s. He saw it coming. So, what does he ask of the church? Not just to critique the state, but to exorcise it. To unmask the spiritual lies that hide under patriotic slogans. To stop worshiping at the altars of relevance, respectability, or return on investment. Because for Stringfellow, the only faithful church is the one that looks like Jesus. Poor, rejected, truth-telling. Willing to die rather than to kill. And maybe the real question isn't whether America is a Christian nation. Maybe it's because the church in America has been so possessed by the empire that it can no longer recognize the difference, whether that be by demons or greed. What does it mean to follow Jesus in a land that confuses power with holiness? That's something worth wrestling with. Stringfellow sums this whole idea up by saying this.
Babel means the inversion of language, verbal inflation, libel, rumor, euphemism and coded phrases, rhetorical wantonness, redundancy, hyperbole, such profusion in speech and sound that comprehension is impaired, nonsense, sophistry, jargon, noise, incoherence, a chaos of voices and tongues, falsehood, blasphemy. And in all of this, Babel means violence.
Babylon is the city of Babel. The emperor worship in Rome had such power, as did the Nazi babble against the Jews, as does general racism and xenophobia here in America. Stringfellow believes that, by the 1970s,
Babel had become the means of ruling the nation, the principal form of coercion employed by the governing authorities against human beings. It is not just that Babel incites violence, but more than that, Babel is violence. Babel is the violence in which physical and psychical aspects are most intermingled or merged. Essentially, Babel targets the faculties of comprehension, sanity, and conscience, which distinguish human beings from other creatures.
Stringfellow concludes his discussion of Babel with the warning from Alexander Solzhenitsyn's 1970 Nobel Address.
Let us not forget that violence does not exist by itself and cannot do so. It is necessarily interwoven with lies. Violence finds its only refuge in falsehood, falsehood its only support in violence. Any man who has once acclaimed violence as his method must inexorably choose falsehood as his principle.
I understand why some people roll their eyes at critiques of religion. If someone finds comfort in angels or purpose in combating demons, who am I to take that from them? personal faith, after all, isn't usually about evidence. It's about experience, conviction, and trust. But my concern isn't with faith itself. It's with a certain kind of belief, biblical literalism, that insists the earth is 6,000 years old, that denies science, and that claims biblical inerrancy and infallibility, that every word of scripture is not only true, but fact, and cannot be challenged because it is God-breathed. This mindset doesn't just stay in church pews, it bleeds into public life, shaping policy, undermining education, and fostering a dangerous suspicion of expertise. Look no further than the handful of people in Trump's administration who have close connections with the Heritage Foundation, the authors of Project 2025. We're living in a post-truth era, and while many point to figures like Donald Trump as the face of it, he's more of a symptom than a cause. Long before him, biblical literalism taught people to reject critical thinking, to distrust scholars, to treat facts as feelings and feelings as facts. Trump simply inherited that rhetoric and ran with it. It's no coincidence that he's become kind of an idol to parts of the religious right. They call him the chosen one, and in return, he's rewarded them, not with integrity, but with power. He's appointed leaders like Pete Hegseth, who closely follows the dominionistic, complementarianism, and exceptionalism teachings of Doug Wilson, and Paula White, who preaches a prosperity gospel that claims God wants you rich, and if you're poor, it's your fault. It's not just unbiblical, it's the opposite of what Jesus taught. So my issue isn't with Christianity, it's with how the message of Christ is being twisted, used as a tool for wealth, power, and political gain. When Trump spent last Easter selling Bibles with his name stamped on the cover, it wasn't just offensive, it was the clearest picture yet of faith turned commodity. And if we take the gospel seriously, it's exactly the kind of moment that would have sent Jesus flipping tables and wielding a whip. The same goes for those who dehumanize others by casting them as demonic, demon-possessed, or taken over by a Jezebel spirit. It's a rhetorical trump card for right-wing authoritarian power moves, an attempt to belittle an individual or group of people and holding a weird obsession with sexual politics. Perhaps Stringfellow was onto something when he claimed that America is a demonic principality. As we look ahead, maybe the real invitation isn't to fight what we fear, but to lean into what brings light. There's a beautiful Greek word, philoxenia, which means love of stranger. You might recognize its opposite, xenophobia, the fear of a stranger. I haven't used that term earlier in this episode. But philoxenia represents a deep cultural value of hospitality and generosity towards guests and travelers. It speaks to something ancient and sacred, a generous spirit, a heart that welcomes, a willingness to make room for someone different. It embodies the idea of welcoming and caring for strangers. This idea is present in Genesis chapter 18, where God visits Abraham in the form of three strangers. Abraham runs to greet them, offers them rest, food, and kindness. And in Hebrews 13, we're reminded, "Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing so, some have entertained angels without knowing it." Hospitality doesn't have to be grand. It can be a smile, a listening ear, a meal shared, and a hand extended. It's about choosing to see the divine in others, even when it's not obvious. Today, philoxenia manifests in various forms, such as inviting guests into homes, sharing meals, or offering assistance to those in need. Acts of kindness, like helping a stranded motorist or providing food to the homeless, are modern expressions of this ancient value. So, I'll leave you with this. What if our energy was better spent not in fighting demons or assigning labels, but in creating space for connection, compassion, and kindness? Because every time we turn away from someone who's different, we might just be turning away from an angel and never even know it.